Thank you, Mrs. Stacy Guerin and Jay Lanahan and Anne Marie Coleman McDonald, this year's Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day Parade, for presenting the first annual Irish Heritage Photo Contest and Exhibit at Zella's Pizzeria, 1145 Holland Street in Baltimore. Exhibit runs through April the 14th, and public voting will determine the winners. It's sponsored by the Maryland Irish Festival.
I'm on.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Cordner, and our engineer is Jake Bryant. We are talking tonight about the legendary Knights Templar, the first multinational corporation and the predecessor of many of our international banking systems today in the West. Our guest is Dr. Karen Rawls, an Oxford scholar and author of the Knights Templar Encyclopedia, the essential guide to the people, places, events, and symbols of the Order of the Temple, which you can order from New Page Books at 1-800-227-3371. Karen Rawls' website is www.ancientquest.com. When we left off last hour, Karen was telling us about some of the historically accurate and still thrilling tales of the Templar Knights breaking down courtroom doors to rescue their fellows on trial. Sometimes the truth is as dramatic as the speculative fictions that are so popular today. In this segment, we are going to find out what happened after the trials. Did the Pope condemn them all as heretics? And where did the escaped Templars go?
The trials were done nation by nation. It was not just one uniform policy. It was very, very diverse. And even after the Pope finally decided, and perhaps rightly we can understand today, it was, you know, he issued a proclamation called a papal bull, stating with the rationale that, well, you know, we've had all these tabloid rumors for 7 years, all these trials and hearings. And at that point, privately, he was really angry at the French king anyway, because he felt outmaneuvered. So he did not ever say that the order itself was guilty. And I want to make that very clear, because there are people out there that think the whole Templar order was heretic or guilt. That's not true. It is not documentable. The Pope said that the order was not guilty. And individuals, that's another matter. But, you know, the order itself was not thought by the Vatican to be guilty per se. But the rationale for suppressing it was the tabloids, the rumor mill, had so destroyed the respectability and credibility of it that he actually thought, okay, it's more sensible to dissolve this particular religious order, the Order of the Temple, and have those knights join other orders. And this is where it gets interesting on what happened after the suppression. Again, it's nation by nation. There was a different story, different scenario, and even in some countries, like in France, for example, two or three different areas where it was different. So there's not a uniform blanket way of viewing this subject, even after the suppression. It's very, very complex. But following the suppression order, everyone's like, well, what happened? Where did they go? You know, some people think they all went to Scotland. No, they didn't. They went a lot of different places. In fact, the question is, where were all the Templars? We don't even know what happened to a fair amount of them. But legally, according to the concerns of the Vatican at the time, understandably, they wanted the religious order knights to remain in a religious order. They had to join another order. Some went to the Benedictines. Some went into various orders, especially in Aragon. The Templars had a lot of power in that area, Spain and Portugal area today. And one of those, you know, we think, you know, the order of, we hear things like Order of Calatrava and Order of Montesa. Those were branches of, you know, and the Order of Christ was the big one. that a lot of the refugee Templars went to, but those weren't the only places. The truth is, for a fair amount of knights in places like Italy and Germany, we just don't know. they were theoretically pensioned out to monasteries. But the point being, again, the records are piecemeal by nation also, and some of the areas we know pretty much what happened to every one of them. Others, we really, it's just a gap, you know? So again, leading back to what you were saying about all these theories and books, and I'm actually glad there's a lot of interest, you know? I'm glad to see the interest, but it does concern me that, you know, sometimes there's too many leaps, and some of the actual history is very interesting.
Yeah.
Like to look at their own rule about their relics. They actually listed that, you know, they did have what they said was the true cross. There was one, I think it's section 122 of their order. It says that they had to have, this was their most precious relic, and that when that relic was taken around to all their, the front of the battlefield before a battle, it had to be guarded by 10 knights who had no purpose other than to be like a shrine guardian and guard it. That's actually in the order, in the rule for itself. They also said they had the crown of thorns, which is no surprise for us really today. And then things like they had heads of, we know, of two female saints. Now, again, this is where it gets interesting, like which saints were they? Well, there's some debate about them. But in my encyclopedia, I get into all the, you know, details about these things. And we're still learning more about them. But there are, you know, some places they had what they called the cross of Caravaca, and they still have that in parts of in Spain. And these relics have ended up in various museums. Again, sometimes it's a small museum, small chapel in Italy, or I found something that was mislabeled. I said, this is a Knight Templar. And the curator didn't have any idea. He was like, oh, God, you know. So they've now relabeled the whole thing. So, I mean, again, history is a living thing. It's a living thing. And the Templar subject is really fascinating. And it's not the only subject that was going on at the time. It's not in a vacuum. The Templars and the Hospitallers, the Knights of Lazarus, all of these orders were interspersed and permeated in and through each other. And that's my point, like, about the Gothic cathedrals. There's a lot of different orders and guilds that would have been, for example, to build Chartres. It's so phenomenal. But it would not have been just one guild, or certainly the Templars only. It would have been a mutual effort on the part of many. And so when the Templars were finally suppressed, there were a few of the officers remained, and unfortunately, this is one of the biggest travesties of medieval history, is the burning of Jacques de Molay, and the whole story is, and obviously it's in my book, but it's very sad to read. He was very elderly at that point, and the French king went ahead and just said, burn him, you know, and it was in 1314 now, and that's 2 years after the official suppression. The treasurer and the grandmaster were burned at the stake very suddenly. So, again, it was an unjust thing in the long run. But so after that, the Templars dispersed. Whoever was left dispersed. Most of them were quite elderly at that point, some of them, who had been in Western Europe managing the local preceptory, for example. So they were pensioned out in various monastic orders and everything. And others disappeared. And again, there's questions about certain ships leaving and, you know, where did they go and what did they leave. And that is an area that is growing in concern. And many people think, oh, maybe they went west to America. But again, where's the concrete evidence? We don't have it. in fact, I wish we did. I wish we had evidence of a lot of this, but we just don't.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
And,
so, but you mentioned the relics of the true cross or the crown of thorns, the heads of two female saints, etc. But also, you know, my fascination always is with symbols and seals and that type of thing.
Yes.
Could you review briefly, because of our limited time, some of their often highly mysterious symbols or seals of the order?
I think one of the most intriguing, I mean, I'll just mention real quickly just the how broad their symbolism was. But one of the main things, of course, we think of today is the Grand Master's seal, which was two knights on one horse. And that is a very ancient symbol, actually. It goes clear back to Sumeria initially. But it is very interesting. Many people think, what does that domed building on the reverse side mean? It's kind of like the reverse side of the Great Seal.
Yeah.
Well, there's a Templar one, Bob. It's the official seal of the Grand Master on one side had what we know or call now the circular dome of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And on the other side is the symbol of the two knights on the one horse. Now, today, outside of the Temple Church in London, there is a sculpture of this two knights on one horse. You can actually see that. So that was the official seal. But the issue, again, it was very regional. And the provinces' grandmasters had their own symbols. And this is where it gets really fascinating and often kind of unusual, because we'll see other symbols depending on the area. Now, another classic symbol of the Templars is the Lamb of God, which, of course, is found in many cathedrals and chapels, too. So it wasn't just a Templar thing. But we also see a fair amount of eagles and castle tower. We don't quite know in all cases what that means. I think it's very fascinating, the tower image. Various crosses, the cross of Lorraine with the double bar, as well as the classic Templar cross, which is red with four equidistant sides. We see that in a lot of their seals and symbols. Doves, stars, 5 points, certain areas, 6 points. A crescent moon, and then there's a tower with a pointed roof and a cross on it. And one of the most unusual symbols, and this is a fact, that on one of the 12th century documents in Paris, where it was found in the National Archives, a symbol that we know is Gnostic. And that might seem a shock, like, that doesn't mean that the whole order was Gnostic. What it means is it appears that the Knights Templar had adopted the image of an ancient, a common practice then was to carve gemstones in the ancient world. And it made its way into medieval guilds, too, of protecting certain areas with symbols, believing that they were protected by angels, to protect certain precious items. The interesting thing about the Templar image was something called a praxis, which is kind of a complex description, but it's like a rooster figure that's got some unusual legs and a serpent that, you can look it up on the internet. But it's very fascinating because it relates to geometry and numerology. But the primary reason they had that, and they had other symbols that we know from Alexandrian Gnostic Christianity. And again, these were used in Christianity. It's not like it was totally a pagan symbol, but it was often believed to provide special protection for precious items. Now, this was found on the Grand Master's seal of the Templars for the Paris treasury. So again, it's quite interesting that we would see this ancient Christian symbol of protection, probably originally from around Alexandria, used in 12th century Paris to perhaps get angelic protection or something for what was in or near the treasury. So that's one thing that is, there's a lot of interesting speculation about that. But again, in other provinces, we have a lot of other symbols that are in many Christian buildings, also in many ancient temples, which, again, a place like Roslyn, for example, is as much of a temple as a church in a way. But the Templars had the fleur-de-lis, of course, the lion, stars, doves, and quite a few towers, and their graves never had the name of the individual knight because it was forbidden to accentuate the ego of the individual over the collective power of the group. The group was always seen as more important than the individual. So if something, that's another point, if someone says, oh, this is a Templar grave, well, the first question would be it shouldn't have a name of an individual, because then that's not really Templar. But usually the grave would have a sword, and oftentimes you'll see an eight-sided floric cross or a flower-like design part of it. And sometimes you'll often see a cross that has like steps. It looks kind of like a ziggurat kind of thing with a Christian cross on the top of it. And that's an old symbol that in later times was called the Calvary Step Cross. We do see this symbol quite a bit in what we, well, it's been dubbed Templar graffiti, in the areas where we know the Templars and even some of their officers, where they were held prisoner. And so it's kind of interesting because we know that it was carved by Templars. So the question is, why do we see sometimes some pretty strange-looking symbols? And this is an area that I find very fascinating to delve into further. But we see things like a hand with a heart on its palm. We see quite a few octagonal symbolism or some geometric grid patterns, you know, like they were working out some kind of geometry, and perhaps almost like an architectural design in some places. And a lot of these step crosses, and very fascinating issue of using doves and crosses and combinations of things. So, again, but it's not uniformly the same everywhere in each Templar place, because it's regional and it depends on what was in that area.
So the known symbols of the Templars were many and varied from nation to nation, though we're still not sure what they meant by some of them. Coming up after this break, we are going on a quest for the Holy Grail. What is the connection between the Knights Templar and the rise of the Grail legends? You'll find out in a few minutes. This is 21st Century Radio, and our guest is Dr. Karen Rawls, author of the Knights Templar Encyclopedia from New Page Books, 1-800-227-3371, www.ancientquest.com.
Being short because you can't sell your house. Contact Harmony Hall Assisted Living Community. Visit www.myhchp.com. Great lunch, Starbucks coffee, wireless internet. Life is good. Oh, and by the way, this is a health park. Visit www.myhchp.com.
Business owners, entrepreneurs, you know you are the engine of the economy, and now more than ever, you need to be proactive and creative to put your business above the rest. That's why you need You Got a Web. YouGotAWeb.com is the one-stop web hub for all your website needs, from inexpensive domains and hosting to customized full website services. YouGotAWeb.com will help you choose just the right level of service for your needs. YouGotAWeb's economical method will guide you step-by-step through a simple interface that will get your website up and running quickly and affordably. And if your needs require a more customized site, then they can create a cutting-edge website just for your unique needs. Why, they even worked with Sean and Frank to create the official WCBM Morning Show website. Don't wait another day. Packages start at $199. Visit or call YouGotAWeb.com, 410-561-2328, 410-561-2328.
The views and opinions of the guests and hosts you hear are not necessarily those of the owners, management, or advertisers of Talk Radio 680, WCBM.
No matter who we are or what we do, our health is a priority. To stay well or to recover from an illness or injury, consider using options that are safe, natural, and in some cases, thousands of years old. From acupuncture to modern-day massage, counseling, and homeopathic medicine, the Ruscomb Mansions Community Health Center offers children and adults numerous health care and support services. Find out more about the Ruscomb Mansions yoga classes and weekend programs. Call 410-367-7300. That's 367-7300.
This is Ed Storms. I'm a researcher in cold fusion, and I'm participating in an interview with 21st Century Radio and Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with me, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, as your host. The history of the influential Knights Templar is our subject tonight with Dr. Karen Rawls, author of Knights Templar Encyclopedia from New Page Books, 1-800-227-3371, ancientquest.com. In this segment, I ask Karen about the Knights Templar and the Holy Grail.
Well, what about the Grail? Do you believe they had the Grail?
Well, the question there would be, what do you mean by the Grail? The Grail is a very fascinating subject, as we know from Indiana Jones on to our modern day. But it actually, the truth is, though, in the medieval manuscripts themselves, and there are many written by many different authors. And the first thing I do want to say, and this is, we know this, that there is no evidence that a Knight Templar ever wrote a Grail romance. And that's been, some people have misconception about that. That doesn't mean that, and there's one or two of them, there's no question there's probably a Templar influence, or perhaps that, the author, a monk, is trying to portray what would be or seem to be a Templar. That I have no problem with. But we're still finding, some of the Grail stories mention, for example, an order of knights that have white robes with red crosses, but then they describe them as being very secular in behavior, which, again, we certainly know that wasn't the way the knights were.
That's right. Yeah.
But the point about the Grail in the manuscripts is actually a spiritual experience. It is not really a material object. And it really goes back to what you said at the very beginning about, it's the inner reality and the interior spirituality of balancing both parts of yourself that is really the focus, and not treasure. Today it's like everyone's on a treasure hunt, but maybe the real treasure lies within. And in a lot of the medieval Latin manuscripts, for example, sometimes the monks are a bit bored, and they'll write something in the margins. Oh, it's great, some great fun. It clarifies things sometimes, but there's about 9 major objects that we know were connected with a knight's experience of the Grail, like Sir Galahad or, Arthur or whatever. But it could be described as a silver platter, a dish called a Grail, a special dish that had, like, the Eucharist or a fish in it, for example, a sword, a bleeding white lance, a dove with the communion host in its beak. Some believe the Grail was actually the secret gospel of St. John. And again, we don't know for sure, but there's all these different forms the Grail could have potentially taken. One of the most common feelings you get when the Grail is described or when someone experiences the Grail is they'll see a blinding light of some type, or they will, or something luminous, mm-hmm. and then they have an inner experience, mm-hmm. an inner reality with God or a higher experience. And Wolfram von Eschenbach is one of the famous authors of the Grail, and he wrote a story called Parzival, which is quite amazing, and it's quite esoteric. It's powerful, but it's unique in a couple ways. I just want to quickly mention this one, because it mentions that the Grail is found in the stars, that it's actually like perhaps a celestial issue that's beyond our ego and our planet, perhaps. It's taking on a universal perspective. And it also talks about the Grail as a luminous stone, a stone from heaven that fell to earth. So it's really one of the few, if any, Grail romance that talks about the Grail as a stone and connects that with light and interior knowledge. Mm-hmm. So there's 9 or 10 different things the Grail can be, but there is no one Grail then. And there's no one Grail story, but there are many Grail seekers.
Well, that seems very appropriate. As above, so below. If it's going to be on one level, it could exist in some other form on another level. And I think that that's one of the great mysteries of all of this. And you mentioned Roslyn Chapel, and there are many popular authors right now that basically feel that's where the Templars went. And of course, Dan Brown certainly encouraged that kind of view. But could we go back to Roslyn Temple? Because you know a lot of experienced a lot there. You were there for some time.
I was just there 2 weeks ago. Roslyn is so phenomenal. I guess the first thing I can say about Roslyn Chapel is I'm very glad of all the interest, and even if it's wildly speculative, I'm very glad the Da Vinci Code came out. I thought Dan Brown wrote an incredibly fascinating thriller. And I'm glad. I think it's good. It's brought a lot of interest to Scotland, by the way, which is good. And the point being, Roslyn Chapel is not just a chapel. It's actually part of two other things that are very, very integral to seeing the whole place. And it's part of a much larger property around it. Of course, we know that the founder was one of the most illustrious Renaissance men of his time, very late Middle Ages, right on the cusp before the Renaissance came in about 1450, you know. Mm-hmm. And his name was Sir William St. Clair. Mm-hmm. So the St. Clair family, we know Sir William's incredible efforts were behind the building of this extraordinary place. But it is on a hill called Collegiate Hill. It is part of an ancient group of Scottish churches called the Collegiate Churches. And Roslyn's official name, of course, is the Collegiate Church of St. Matthew. And it is part of the idea of a church being not only a holy place, a place of worship, but a place of education, college, collegiate education, learning, this type of thing. I like to think of Roslyn today, and many, many people agree that it's, you know, you walk in and it's not just a chapel. You know it when you're there, but you can't quite put your finger on why, because it has that extra element of helping through the symbolism and the placement of certain symbols in certain places to aid the visitor, the viewer, to help them experience where something interior, if they're meant to do that at that time. In that sense, it's like a type of temple. But Roslyn, back to my original point, is not only a chapel. It's part of the glen, the land around it, which is quite extensive. There's a lot of hiking area around it and forest. And there's the ruins of what was the Roslyn Castle. So it's really a tripartite, three-part site of castle, glen, and chapel. So Roslyn is not just about the carvings inside. It's about the whole matrix of place around it also. Mm-hmm. But it is very special to not only the St. Clair family, it's very, very special to Freemasons, in particular those of the Royal Arch. I can't tell you how many times we would be there working on a curatorial case or a new object was found or something. And, you know, a couple of American, I think one was a judge, and they were Masons. They walked in, and I said, oh, well, this is Royal Arch. And they went right over it, and they discussed it. And, you know, we went to dinner, and I learned an awful lot about some of, you know, their stories about the founding of the temple and their legends. And it's all very fascinating, integral place of using what I think is a very powerful system of symbols and allegory in a process of unfolding in us as viewers. And that was what was really going on in much of the Middle Ages with the guilds. It happens to many today at Chartres. I led a tour to Chartres last September, and we had a lot of interesting, those of us modern-day people were saying things that I was thinking, this is interesting. It could have fit right into a 12th century pilgrim's story, you know, of how a place affects you. And Roslyn is about the power of the symbols. And Sir William was very astute and very aware of how he was putting this system together to help teach and learn for prosperity. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to leave something for us today.
Well, one of the things that's quite, well, it's repeated often within the Roslyn Temple is the Green Man. Could you tell us a little bit about who this Green Man is? And
the Green Man is really great. It's very fascinating, and I guess the first thing I would say, I know the women out there will love this, well, there wasn't just a green man. There was also a green lady.
How shocking.
Carving.
That's shocking.
And she's at Roslyn. And guess what? We don't hear about her too much.
No.
But the point is, yes, the green man is a very ancient symbol of, it's obviously very old, much older than the church. But we must ask ourselves, you know, why would this image of what looks like a severed head with greenery growing out of his mouth, like vines, and, you know, and they're found in India, Borneo, all, you know, it's not just in Western Europe, but certainly by the 6th, 7th century, we start seeing them in Italy. And by the time, you know, not 10th, 11th, 12th, we see quite a bit of it all over Europe. But he symbolizes renewal and growth, reinvigoration, and a certain kind of awareness. And this is very good today with our new environmental awareness, the connection between the human and the nature, and humanity and nature. And this is very much a theme of the symbolism of much of Roslyn. In fact, the four seasons are present. When you walk around, you'll notice, you know, all these green man images, and people think, well, wow, they're not all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what is extraordinary. There are over 320 of these green man images in what is admittedly a very rather small, compact chapel, more so than any other building in medieval Europe. And it just seems really incredible that the founder would include this. But it is, again, it's part of the Glen, you know, the chapel. Some people say it's the chapel of the Grail because it's near this greenery in the Glen, and it has these huge foliage of real trees outside, and then you walk in the chapel, and there's all these green men. But the green lady, there's two green ladies as you approach the edge of the Lady Chapel and head down to the crypt. And it's quite interesting. They have long hair, and they're on either side. So it is part of the symbolism, but it's not the only meaning of the chapel.
Indeed, the green man is not the only meaning of the Roslyn Chapel. When we return, we will find out more of the mysteries that Dr. Karen Rawls has uncovered at Roslyn Chapel and the surrounding Templar shrines. This is 21st Century Radio, and we're talking about the Knights Templar Encyclopedia from New Page Books and AncientQuest.com. We'll return after these messages.
Milton Lynn for Harford Coin Company. If you own rare coins, currency, metals, or tokens and are considering selling the same, do yourself a favor. If you wish to receive the highest fair market value for your items, do not take them to the out-of-town buyers or the motel buyers on weekends. You will not receive the highest fair market value for your items. The generalist who will buy everything from your pearls to your paintings to your jewelry and flatware are not specialists in rare coins. We are, with 45 years of experience buying coins of the world from the ancient Roman and Greek to the most recent of U.S. Mint issues. Call us at 410-665-1814, Harford Coin Company. We buy U.S., worldwide, ancient Roman, Greek, and private mint issues such as Franklin Mint and others. Again, call us at 410-665-1814. We also will travel to buy substantial collections. Thank you.
I was born for adventure.
I was born to lead.
I was born to help people.
I was born to be a National Guard soldier.
Because I'm a doer.
Because I want to serve.
Because I'm compassionate.
The Guard lets me fulfill a tradition of proud military service.
Like the founders of our nation.
Like my father.
We are leaders of tomorrow.
Whenever the call comes,
I'll be ready.
My unit responds and takes action.
Because we're trained professionals.
Because those are my neighbors.
The community can trust that we will be there to help.
In a flood.
In a hurricane.
In any disaster nature throws our way.
We'll bring food and water.
We'll get people their medicine.
We'll get the community back on its feet.
No matter what the challenge is,
we're trained to overcome it.
I will stand up to protect my nation.
Whether it's a threat at home or overseas,
we will bravely face it as National Guard soldiers.
In the National Guard, you can proudly serve your community and your country. Call 1-800-GO-GUARD and ask us about the job opportunities available in your state.
Sponsored by the Maryland National Guard and aired by the Maryland, D.C., Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Baltimore's Best Weekend Talk Show has a new name. Join me, Tom Moore, every Saturday night at 10 for the Antwerp and Tom Moore Show. The same great commentary, hot topics, and entertainment. The Antwerp and Tom Moore Show on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Ever heard of Tippy the Wonder Dog, Mary Backstage, Noble Wife, or Matt Neffer, Boy Spot Welder? All characters of Radio's greatest satirist, Bob and Ray, are subject to Sunday, plus a solartopia vision for the planet. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM. If you're a business owner or executive seeking growth yet determined to cut wasteful costs, consider outsourcing your whole marketing department to The Selling Well. The Selling Well offers businesses truly superior marketing services without all the overhead costs associated with employing a full-time marketing executive. Learn more online at theSellingWell.com. That's theSellingWell.com, named after one of our greatest symbols of prosperity, the well. Visit theSellingWell.com or call The Selling Well's managing partner, Plato Hieronymus, at 443-939-1890. TheSellingWell.com.
Hi, this is Paul Grishkin, rock and roll historian. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Yeah, let's go rocking down the highway.
This is 21st Century Radio, and I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and we're concluding now with our interview recorded last week with medieval historian Dr. Karen Rawls on the secrets of the Knights Templar and why they are still so fascinating today. You can order her book from NewPage at 1-800-227-3371 or visit her website at ancientquest.com. After we hear more of the deeply rich mysteries of Scotland's Roslyn Chapel, remember, this is where the climax of the Da Vinci Code took place, Karen's going to tell us how a Templar prophecy might relate to the upcoming year of 2012. But first, what are some of the influences behind the many different carvings at Roslyn?
We see a combination of Old Testament, New Testament, pagan, some say Sufi, Masonic, all kinds of different types of carvings. And some of the carvings, however, have been badly damaged. Some have been altered, you know, through time, and there's been a lot of, it's in my book about some of that. And the one thing I do want to say, no, the Knights Templar did not build Roslyn Chapel, but they did have very nearby, in what is today still called the Village of Temple, ironically, very appropriate. What that was called Ballantraddock, which was the headquarters of the medieval Scottish Knights Templar. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't at Roslyn per se, but it was very close by. The village, I think today it's about 10-15 minute drive, not far. So the point being that there was, you know, there was a lot of interplay, but, you know, the Templars did not build Roslyn. So, but again, it's still a symbolic place in that it embodies a message of, again, many go there and see it one way the first time they visit. They'll go a year or two later, and they'll see it totally differently. Kind of like a lot of people say about certain scriptures or ancient readings, you know, it depends on where an individual is in their own individual spiritual journey, how a place will strike them or what will pop out at them, you know? So Roslyn's message is not just about the early Christian history there and the St. Clair family, which is very, very fascinating and important. It has a Masonic history in Scotland. It has very important, obviously, guilds that built the place and were part of it. It is, again, I want to emphasize a lot of early Scottish traditions that were already indigenous to the area and around there. Some even have speculated about, you know, Sir Gawain the Green Knight. You know, the earliest ballad is in the, you know, Midlothian or lowland area of Scotland, which isn't terribly far away from Roslyn. So, again, there's all these different local and broader perspectives that come together at this place.
A good example of that was when you come to the Black Madonna. You have from pages 36 to almost 40. Okay. We have 41. This is just wonderful, this particular area, for, as far as I'm concerned, because so much has been made from the Da Vinci Code about black Madonnas. In the interest of time, because we just have maybe around 10 minutes at the most left, could we touch on the black Madonna and what this particularly means? Because I was fascinated that some of them were painted black. I didn't know that. Yeah. I thought they just darkened. So there was intention. There was some kind of intention to make them black. Some of them.
It is very fascinating, especially for those of us who weren't actually brought up Catholic. I mean, it's quite shocking to find out that, you know, not all of the beautiful Blessed Mother, Our Lady of Virgin Mary statues were actually white or light colored. Most of them are, but not all of them. But what's really interesting when you study pilgrimage in the 12th century in particular, some of the most popular shrines were for these images of Our Lady, and still are, by the way, many of them, where she was actually painted black, as you say, or in some cases made out of jet, like black stone or ebony or something. So the question is, why? Why would this be there at all? What does she mean? What's going on here? And again, church historians have studied this and debated it, and they kind of kiboshed it for quite a long time because it was seen as not terribly relevant to the larger picture. But today, as you say, there is a lot of interest in this, and partly because of the clustering of the bulk of the imagery, which is around the Languedoc area in Provence and France and certain areas of Italy and areas that, you know, we do know there were, you know, some interesting alternative things going on. Well, I just want to real quickly mention that, you know, the High Middle Ages is not just about Christianity. There were a lot of really important Kabbalistic academies, especially in Girona and Spain and parts of all over France, the various areas. In fact, there were some translators of Hebrew that were working with Bernard of Clairvaux and other monasteries, and some of the Templars knew them, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a Jewish thing going on, and then, of course, medieval Spain, there was a Sufi Islamic influx of knowledge into Western Europe, which was really radical. It was like shocking new knowledge, and it was a bit of a right to the church in some ways. But the point being, they brought their symbols and their traditions with them. And we know that many of the art historians who've studied the Black Madonna that I've spoken with in many countries do think that there were certain ancient goddess traditions that had a black goddess, a mother goddess image. Of course, Isis, you know, nursing Horus. Some of her images are, I mean, obviously she was Egyptian, a dusky lady, and others were like Artemis of Ephesus and Cybele. There were other ancient goddesses, and we know the Romans came quite early with the three Matronas images from Rome when they came into Gaul, and they brought some of their images. They had black stone. So the question is, you know, it's sort of like a lot of churches were built on top of earlier pagan sites. Some of these images that were perhaps ancient or more pagan were then Christianized. But there is a special meaning, I think, that the Black Madonna has, very special, and it's very biblical. It relates to the Song of Songs and other scriptures, the concept of a special lady called Wisdom. And it's sort of, she's embodied often in parts of even the idea of the unformed, unmanifest archetypal wisdom that is the backdrop of our world. You know, it's sort of like a painting. You go to a museum, you see the highlights and you see the shadows. You see the forefront, you see the background. It's sort of the other half of the story, the other half of the picture that you need to see the whole. So the Black Madonna possibly, could symbolize a Christian acknowledgement of the Lady Wisdom. The reason I take this position is that St. Bernard of Clairvaux was known to be an absolute avid Marianist. I mean, just so extraordinary. He did all these sermons interpretations on the Song of Songs. And as I mentioned earlier, he was the main advocate for the Knights Templar, you know, to get them made official.
Well, I found the listing in here of concerning the Black Madonna extraordinary. As you know, Black Madonna is not identical with Saint Mary Magdalene, and yet, of course, that is very popular right now with
popular
New Agers.
Book, but it's good on the Gazette in the back about pilgrimage sites is quite interesting.
Yes.
But the issue of Sophia, the mother, the
Sophia.
Universal mother of wisdom, is interesting because, in a philosophical sense, and this is getting off into philosophy and theology, but she is the unmanifest wisdom behind our phenomenal or apparent reality. She's the deeper, darker, secret truth. And, you know, it's just possible that some of the church fathers did not, therefore, object to the Black Madonna. The other thing I want to mention about the Templars, people think, oh, maybe the Templars worship the Black Madonna. Well, at that point, they probably did. All good, devout Christians would have. It wasn't considered a heresy.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't considered, worship or to venerate, as opposed to worship. To venerate the Black Madonna was seen as an honorable thing. So, you know, again, that would not have necessarily, on its own, been seen as heretical.
Were there female Templars?
There were. We know there were not. They were not allowed to be full knights or dames, but we have quite a bit of evidence from donations of land that women were very key, especially widows would give, sometimes they were quite wealthy, would give large tracts of land to the Order of the Temple, and they were made, like we might say, like Smithsonian or a museum. They have an organization called Friends of the Museum, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they did. They had it. They called them a soror, a sister, or a friend of the order. And you know, there were quite a few women, you know, powerful, wealthy women in certain areas that were known to be key patrons and supporters. Although, of course, they weren't allowed to live on the property. But sometimes they had a women's house nearby that they would help out with some of the tasks. And it was such a huge organization. You know, it was just massive. I mean, but of course, it was primarily male, and we know that they were very strict about that as far as full membership. They did have, by the way, 4 or 5 or 6 different levels of membership for men, too, and very, you know, very few, I think only 20% or something, were actually full knights. You know, the others were like sergeants and different levels. So, I mean, you know, it was quite a big thing to be a full knight for a man. So for a woman to be acknowledged, especially in the 12th century like that, it's really quite interesting.
Well, we are really out of time right now, and yet there is still, I would love for the last question dealing with, you know, we are moving towards 2012. How might that be relevant to the High Middle Ages?
I know we've all heard about the Mayan prophecies, and I think that it's very interesting, and the concept of, you know, within their civilization. But it's interesting because in 1312, as I mentioned earlier, the Knights Templar were officially suppressed by the church. And, of course, 700 years later is 2012. So it's interesting because there was an old Languedoc folk saying, it sort of has several different versions, but it uses a plant or a green image as an analogy for death and renewal of an idea or a concept.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the laurel plant. And it says, after 700 years, the laurel will grow green again. Isn't it interesting that nearly 700 years since the original arrest, of course, 1307, 2007, just 1 year after the Da Vinci Code came out, and now we're moving up to, you know, to 2012. Around 700 years later, we are seeing, aren't we, an incredible renaissance of interest in the Knights Templar.
Indeed.
Fascinating. We're seeing it in the Cathars. We're seeing it in the Grail. We're seeing all these subjects that, you know, you mentioned at the beginning about What does all of this mean for us today? And, you know, why should we care, so to speak? And I think we are searching for roots in the West. We are searching for that truth at the root of not only ourselves, but our nation and our world. And we are finding, I think the Internet has helped connect us all much more, not only with words, but it's also the issue of symbols. And I know there's been a lot of all kinds of speculation about symbols. Much of it is not accurate. But some of it, it's good to see the interest. Mm-hmm. And we need to further clarify what these symbols mean, and you have to look at their context. But there's no question that 700 years after the suppression of the order, we are now seeing, you know, in a sense, a whole new renaissance, new perspective. In that sense, Dan Brown's been a fabulous thing.
Indeed. Oh,
you know?
Yes.
So
no doubt about it.
I welcome the interest on all levels. I'm not afraid to interact with people about it. I think it's great. And I think it's great. It's better than just vegging out in front of the telly. You know?
That's for sure, and that's the reason why this book is great. Knights Templar Encyclopedia, The Essential Guide to People, Places, Events, and Symbols of the Order of the Temple. Dr. Karen Rawls, and she's also the author of The Templars and the Grail, published by New Page Books. Thank you ever so much for joining us, Dr. Karen Rawls.
And thank you very much.
So it wasn't that much better than vegging out in front of the telly, as Dr. Rawls just said. We obviously have the highest regard for Dr. Rawls' standard of research, and we'll encourage you one more time to order her books from New Page, either by calling 1-800-227-3371 or by visiting her website at ancientquest.com. Join us next week on 21st Century Radio when our subjects will be old-time radio comedy team Bob and Ray, followed by a discussion about solar energy and how it could convert our planet into Solartopia. See you next week on 21st Century Radio. Well, I have a few more minutes, and during that time, I want to tell you about the great news that Leon Day is smiling down from heaven today because his namesake and grandson, 14-year-old Leon Newkirk, has been nominated to represent the state of Maryland as a national scholar at the National Young Leaders Conference in Washington, D.C. this summer. And the bad news is that accepting this honor comes with a $2,000 price tag to cover the tuition and housing costs for this 10-day event. And in order to raise this money, Geraldine Day has been asking her brothers and sisters in her church and Bible study groups and other friends to pitch in. And my wife and Zahara have offered to match every donation that comes in. Now, you'll be hearing more about Leon Day's grandson, Leon Newkirk's, becoming a national scholar perhaps this week, thanks to my favorite Sun sports writer, David Steele, who is presently working on an article on Leon Day's grandson and his big honor. And we are talking with television stations who want to assist Brother Leon Newkirk and his successful journey to the National Young Leaders Conference in Washington, D.C. Yes, Cooperstown. And its Hall of Famer, Leon Day, is smiling down from heaven today. That's an extraordinary event for this young man's life. And, of course, you know, we had such a good time last night at the important CANE event at the National Federation for the Blind. And I know that our new friends, Charlie Brown and Charlie Brown Sr. and Jr., will be happy to know that Bob and Ray will be joining us tomorrow. I mean, not tomorrow, but next Sunday night here on 21st Century Radio.
And the place it's coming from is inside you. Now your payment's overdue. Oh, the rising sun. Oh, the rising sun.
Baltimore. From ABC News.